Hey, and welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon.
How are you
doing,
Phil?
Yes,
good afternoon.
We're feeling pretty good. We want to thank everybody right at the top. Our fundraising has been all across the station. It's been great. This is the 25th year in growing, and I think we've been doing it. And particularly speaking for the Tater Report, I'm overwhelmed at the kind of response we're getting. We have had from actually all quarters of the world, and of course from all quarters of the world represented also here in Toronto. We're going to take that as a sign of encouragement. We're going to keep doing it. By the way, we always tell you, I hope that you can write to us, taylor@caut.fm, and you can check us out, taylor-report.com, for previous programs. Today we're going to be talking with Ann Garrison, who's done outstanding work in following events in Rwanda, but particularly in the matter of the attempt by Victoire Ingabire, a Rwandan woman who is, I think, 43 years old. She left Rwanda in 1994. She went abroad to study, and she was in Holland at the time of the breakdown of the negotiations and ceasefire and the murder of the president and the subsequent war and the massacre. She was abroad. And she is an advocate for democratic change in the country. She returned there in 2010 to support her party the Democratic, I think it's called the Rwandan Democratic Forces. And she was, as many people expected, arrested for attempting to enter into Rwandan politics. And her hope was to register her party. She was not allowed. She hoped to challenge the president for the office of the president. And instead, she ended up arrested and kept off the scene while the election went forward. And by the way, I want you to know, the British and American embassies, the French, were all delighted because the president, Paul Kagame, without opposition, managed to win 98% of the vote. And as you know, Washington doesn't have any standards in terms of necessary having an opposition.
And I think they're out looking for the 2%.
They want to know where they are and what their phone number is and what, you know, and at 10 o'clock where they are. Anyhow, it is a bitter, bitter story. Now, there's been a development in the Ingabire matter. She has had a trial, and I want you to italicize the word trial. There were, I think, four witnesses against her. They were people who were incarcerated and who said, yes, they were involved with her. It is really quite a story. We're looking forward to talking. Ann Garrison will fill us in on the details of it. I wanted to set that context because this is the result of an intervention by the United Nations. And since we're watching one in Syria today, we need Rwanda. We need Ivory Coast, actually, too. We need Libya as a way to judge the intentions of great powers and how honorable they are and what their real intentions are. But in telling this story, we'd like to highlight the following. We're on the cusp of something really momentous. That is, the U.S. was set out some months back using its NATO allies to bring down the Assad government in Syria. And they tried to get a UN resolution to justify themselves. They brought sanctions, they brought all kinds of threats, there was rumblings along the border, etc. But then they went for the resolution. Something happened that hasn't happened in a long time. The government of China and the government of Russia said no. This is a Security Council, and you required them to say yes. Otherwise, you're on your own, Jack, as they say, or hit the road, Jack. It might be another way to put it. So This is kind of knocked those with an aggressive strategy off balance. And there is reference continually to justify the so-called Chapter 7 intervention, humanitarian, responsibility to protect, R2P, or as we call it here, R2P on you. And we've had a lot of experience with the subject of Rwanda. We have spoken to former ministers, former prime minister of the country. We have talked to former military people. We've talked to doctors and lawyers. And incidentally, I said doctor, magic word. We had Dr. Ruta Singwo, a very important figure in Rwanda. And this does relate to what is going on in Syria today, just if you bear with me, as they say. Dr. Ruta Singwo told us that he was one of the closest advisors and associates to General Paul Kagame. General Paul Kagame was a Ugandan general who was part of an invasion of Rwanda from Uganda, which was then characterized as a rebellion by the international community, just as today they have a rebellion they're talking about in Syria, and they are supplying the U.S. State Department, and President Obama himself says they are supplying night goggles. This is called non-lethal force. Well, you know, if a guy carrying a gun has night goggles, you have enabled him to kill somebody. That's why I suppose you did that. To call it non-lethal, you ought to be kicked in the seat of the pants for that, just as you ought to be kicked in the seat of your pants for having men serving in your service who cut the hands off people and body parts and put them on show and enjoy that. The president ought to consider, you know, saying, hey, I don't want to lead such a group. Anyway, Dr. Ruta Singwo told us that the seminal event, that is the assassination of Habyarimana in Rwanda, was done by the Ugandan army general, Paul Kagame, on his orders. And he knows because his evidence is, they said, well, how do you know that? He says, he told me. That's called direct evidence. That's not, I heard somebody say that he said. No, no, he said, he told me. He said he did it in a typical way. He was bragging. But that's kind of important. Now, I want our listeners to know, he has appeared in front of a French judge now. This is our latest, that's about 3 days ago. called to talk to the investigating judge. France has got an embarrassing situation. They've had an investigation going on into the assassination of Habyarimana since 1994. That's many long years ago, but the investigation continues. And I love this because he said he talked to them for 6 hours, and he told them all that. He told them that he had not only, by the way, did he have his own information. He said there are others, and he gave them the names of people who were party to the assassination. I'm reminding you, that assassination triggered the war, and the official, the kind of Toronto Star Globe and Mail version, that would be the sugared water they deliver every morning for you, has always tried to make out that this was the assassination had been the result of act of Hutu extremists. Dr. Ruta Singwo and many, many others, such as Professor Renchens, an absolute stone authority on the subject, and other close observers have said that it was the work of the RPF. Now, so Ruta Singwo had told us that. Now he's gone in front of a French judge. It's important to review these things because I'm reading accounts in the Arab media. I don't read Arabic, but I do read the translations. They're talking about how they have the opposition in Syria, the armed opposition, has got itself into an interesting problem. They wanted to be rescued, a la Libya. But this time, the Russians and the Chinese have kind of complicated this because they haven't agreed to go along. It's a little harder for the Marine Corps or the Norwegian Air Force or the Canadian submarines to do their duty and help out the armed rebels of Homs, I guess, when the Russians and Chinese are there and saying we don't approve and this is now a UN situation. So we need to review how Habyarimana found himself in a situation where he was assassinated, because the Arab media is talking about people wanting to attack President Assad of Syria because they're losing face and they're also being a little bit wrong-footed by the other side. And so they're thinking of desperate measures. I hate to have to say that, but that's what I read in very reputable media. And we want to keep thinking about that, because in the case of Rwanda, President Habyarimana agreed to UN personnel coming to his country. But he said, now look, we are a sovereign country. You can't just go anywhere, anytime. And you have to act within the mandate. You cannot change it, because I hope people know there's an expression called mission creep. And it's usually caused by people, creeps on a mission. And what they do is they come into your country and they say, oh, yes, you know, rule one, rule two, rule three. And then they say, oh, but by the way, subsection C under three gives us the right to arrest General so-and-so. And you say, no, no, it doesn't say that. And next thing you know, you have a crisis. For a sovereign country to allow UN personnel, they have to be very careful. And already the Star and the Globe and the New York Times are worrying, because the UN guys aren't armed. I don't know what they think 200 guys with guns would do except get themselves annihilated. There are probably street gangs that could take out those guys. So this is a big deal to them. Why? Because they want to muscle Assad. They already know who the villain is. This is a case of give him a fair trial and hang him. This is how they view the situation. So in the case of Habyarimana, he trusted them. And I would say the first dirty trick was that the Belgians were allowed to be part of the UN contingent. Oh, and who were the Belgians? Well, they were the best armed, with the best logistics and the best knowledge of Rwanda. And they were the ones who most favored the so-called rebel army. And their behavior was so egregious that General Dallaire of Canada actually had to send a group of them home, because they were picking fights with civilians and some members of the Rwandan army in bars and whatnot. And then, just to show that the Belgians don't discriminate, they were also beating up on Bangladeshis who were there as part of a UN contingent. I think it was beating the Bangladeshis that did it, because they said it really wouldn't look good, actually, if members of the UN peacekeeping group began to kill each other in front of the African hosts. It's such a bad example. The children, you know, got to be put out of the room while these things happen. So it really, frankly, if I, you know, looking back, I think that Habyarimana should have put his foot down and said, you know, all of you go home, and when you can behave, then you can come to my country. But the Belgians made a mess of things. And they kept, it was France primarily, who kept telling President Habyarimana, okay, things are going to be all right. You keep negotiating. Yes, it's true. There are violations of the ceasefire, and there are assassinations going on now. It's strange. And this will happen in Syria. People will be killed, and no one will know who did it. But the Western media, I guarantee you, will say it was Assad. Anything that happens now is untoward in the country, just as leading up to this point, will be attributed to him. He's going to be the bad guy. And it will weaken, they will try to use this to weaken his authority within his party and within the government of the country. In the case of Habyarimana, he had the United Nations presence, because a lot of people say you have to have a UN presence to get things done. And they say we don't want another Rwanda. If you look at the story of Rwanda, it was a UN presence played, I'm not going to say decisive, but it played a major role in what happened. They were not observing. They became players. And so this is the factor that must be kept in mind, because Ban Ki-moon could not be more loyal to the U.S. He's been they regard him as just, you know, Brother Ban, I think. And then Kofi Annan has been brought in. Kofi Annan was the man that they used to remove the world's, the choice of the world's governments for the leader of the United Nations was Boutros-Ghali. Madeleine Albright, speaking for the United States, having one vote, said, "We don't want him. We want somebody else." And everybody else, and there had been no problem with Boutros-Ghali, except that Americans didn't want him. So they said, "Well, who do you want?" And then they said, "We want Kofi Annan." So they got him. So Kofi Annan is now running this operation in Syria. So everybody better mind their P's and Q's. So I think based on the Rwanda experience, what you have to say is unless they play by the absolute rules, all elements who care about a peaceful resolution of these Syrian crisis, if they study the Rwandan one, notice all the similarities and watch out for a destabilization because the armed groups want first to be legitimized and they're going to demand a certain portion of power. Then they're going to want to be part of the cabinet. And they're going to want new rules altogether, which they will write. And in the case of the Rwanda Patriotic Front, they got those things. They got a lot of it. They were given a majority of the officers were to be from the RPF. 50% of the soldiers, 40% of the soldiers were to be from the RPF. And then when all these things were in place, then they assassinated Habyarimana and resumed the war. And the UN fiddled and everything went up in flames. So this is the elements of it, and to my mind, that should be watched. And don't let anybody tell you, we don't want another Rwanda. If you allow Kofi Annan license, you'll get another Rwanda because this is about regime change. And Susan Rice has made it very clear. That's what the President of the United States, he's already made up his mind. He says the President of Syria has to go. That isn't proper. That's not right. That's not his decision. That's a question for the Syrians to decide. But if they've already done that and they're giving night goggles to armed groups who, as Phil, you were telling me earlier, advocate sectarian warfare. Now, as a matter of fact, I'm going to interrupt myself here. Phil, tell me, you saw this on Al Jazeera.
On Al Jazeera last night, it was an Al Jazeera reporter who was talking to a rebel in Homs, and the rebel's house had been burned. The reporter presented the burning of the home as an act of the Syrian government, although they didn't say how they knew that. And they spoke to a young rebel.
Well, it's Al Jazeera.
Right.
They don't need right. evidence.
And they spoke to a young rebel, and he said, "Well, Assad did this, and they think they can stop us." And he said, "But you know, the reason why they got me was because that town over there, right next door to our town, is a Shia town, and they're all traitors and spies, and they all snitch on us, because they know when Assad goes, they're going to be gone." And the Al Jazeera reporter says, "Oh, okay." I thought, "Oh, yeah. Well, that sounds like a call for sectarian warfare."
It is a call for it. It's also a call for murder.
Yeah.
The U.S. is comfortable with that. Canada is very comfortable with it.
Al Jazeera is comfortable with it.
Yes.
It looks like.
And the New York Times and other papers and any paper who plays that game of continually calling the leadership Alawi is inciting hatred. And incidentally, the Angry Arab and other people, and I call on Angry Arab because he does read Arabic and he follows very closely, but he points out the Syrian government does not use sectarian language, but the so-called rebels do use it. So for the Globe, Star, New York Times, and others to talk about Assad as Alawi and his Alawi group, these are people not qualified to say that. They don't speak Arabic. They don't really know that culture. And as there was a long letter I read from a gentleman who lives in Aleppo, Syria, and he says, "I laugh when I read these Western papers. They talk about this." He says, "Aleppo, the support for the government is not coming from the Alawi." He said, "We have very few Alawi here." He says, the army people, political people, whatnot, these are just government people. So this is an open, naked attempt to create sectarian strife where people are killed because they're members of a church or members of a mosque or synagogue, whatever. You choose to label them. And the onus is put on the Syrian government, when in fact the onus, we have to call people into account now. Just as during the Libya episode, we pointed out that the papers here were engaging in a type of hate mongering by saying that Gaddafi had thousands of African mercenaries. There's never been any evidence of that, none. But we have had Africans killed. We've seen them lynched. There is ample footage, and the West's most respected human rights organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, I don't have a lot of respect for them, but they're real. They make reports. They said that Africans were targeted, are targeted, and are being killed, and are being deprived of work, education, every other thing. By the way, these are Libyans who are happen to be black, but because the sectarians that are from the Benghazi leadership don't like Africans, don't like black people, they are crushing them. But we're not hearing any mea culpas from the editorial writers of our media saying, you know, we kind of indulged in that stuff. Without any evidence. Oh, what they did was quote the sectarian elements who were saying, oh, you know, Gaddafi is using his African mercenaries. That is the height of irresponsibility.
You know, Phil, I would expect no less from the New York Times and the Globe and Mail and the Washington Post. But what I find very distressing is that the American left is silent. In fact, they're sitting there cheering for the intervention.
Many.
I read alternate.
Not
I read,
all. But
yeah. Well, you're right, not all. But I mean, I
a disreputable portion.
Right. I read 80%. This alternate every day, and it's weird. I mean, they present, they will have article after article going after the U.S. empire for all kinds of things, and then they'll turn around and say, oh, well, you know, look at this wonderful stuff we're doing in Syria. You know, we're going to help bring democracy to the Syrians. Well, where have they brought democracy to anybody?
Right. And when are they interested? We pointed out, I mean, to cite Chomsky's reasoning on it, he says, please don't raise the subject of democracy. You removed the president of Haiti. You participated in his removal. You actually flew him out of the country. You didn't protect him. He was the democratically elected president. His term had not expired. But Powell put him on a plane and under threat of, you know, it's either this or those guys are going to kill you. That was basically what he was told. So, of course, this is absurd. We've talked about it. The main supporter of the armed groups in Syria are the emirs of Qatar. I hope I'm getting it all confused. They might be kings. I know they're absolute, and they have a ton of dough. And they are. And as again, I cite, go to the Angry Arab. He has a chapter and verse. He says once a week they announce a new guerrilla brigade of the Syrian resistance, and he says they name these after members of the royal family in Saudi Arabia. So what is it you think you're getting, all you so-called progressives in North America? I mean, you're getting what you want. You only know your own culture, you only respect your own, and you have no use for people in the other part of the world. That's all it means, is that... French experienced this, by the way, during the struggle with Algeria. They had problems with the French left. Many of their sons and daughters were joining the army of the French army to crush the Algerians, which means we have a long way to go yet in the concept of internationalism, common humanity. It's believed that this is a lesser people, and you have to bring them enlightenment, etc. Like the Kony Project. I see stadiums full of white people saying, let's go catch Kony. And I'm saying, that's a familiar sight. You know, that leads to people like Mr. Zimmerman. He probably is part of the Let's Go Get Kony project. He is out on bail. So he, for all I know, he's gone off to get Kony. I remind you that we're going to be talking with Ann Garrison pretty soon, probably about 5-10 minutes. And we're going to review the really stark situation of the what has occurred in the trial of Victoire Ingabire. I'm going to tell you about a website that you can, well, one, you can go to ngarrison.com. I'll be telling you during the interview. But also there's a site, Victoire-Ingabire.org, where you can get an update. You know, almost daily they have some news from the her trial. It just in outline form, she has dismissed her lawyer now because she had called one witness on her own behalf, and the witness was treated in such a way, and the evidence was treated in such a way that she stood up and said, I really don't want to be part of a show trial. And so she asked her counsel to leave. And being a Rwandan court, they're happy to accommodate her. They say that she'll, as far as I know, she's going to have to come to court. Or they say they're not going to be coercive. She can stay home, stay in cell if she likes. And she doesn't have to be represented. And because really, the only thing, if you want to have a pure democracy with a 98% vote for the president, you should have only prosecutors and no defense counsel. That sort of reflects the 98% concept that you don't need lawyers to represent, and you certainly don't need evidence. Witnesses. She pointed out to the court that, of course, no one in her right mind would now come into that courtroom on her behalf, because they would be sitting next to her in a cell, or maybe not, maybe in solitary. And Phil, you like to talk, you raise this matter of progressives. They're not a peep out of anybody to speak of. I mean, there is a group of lawyers who know the case and are very brave, Chris Black, Philippe La Rochelle, David Jacobs, Charles Roach. They know, and they've fought, it's considered a case, it's a political issue that's too dangerous because of the attachment of the word genocide. So you can't talk about Ms. Ingabire's rights, and you can't talk about her political views.
In fact, you just don't talk about her, and I've yet to find a single North American mainstream newspaper that has had any reporting on this issue at all. It's as if it's not happening and doesn't exist.
You know, there's some slight reporting from Holland, but disappointingly little. That's because NATO is a gang, and when a gang leader says, "I don't want you to play that up," people don't play it up, and the poodles who serve, you know, here, they just do their job. I don't know if this is going to work as a joke. I saw something I want to bring to people's attention. The Iran is going to make a copy of the U.S. drone. The other day, when I say copy, I mean one that flies. And they announced information that they have obtained from taking it apart. And it was the kind of detailed information that should make your skin crawl if you were one of the drone chiefs, you know. And so the French press went looking for some American to bark back at the Iranians after the Iranians said they were going to do this. And lo and behold, they found the man they call the influential U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman. He swiftly, can you imagine Joe Lieberman doing anything swiftly, dismissed the general's remarks as Iranian bluster. He says there's some history here of Iranian bluster, particularly now that they're on the defensive because of our economic sanctions. Somebody's really proud of economic sanctions against them, said Lieberman. And then it goes on. It says, the unmanned bat-winged Sentinel drone, and I thought they were talking about Lieberman. Actually, it turns out they're talking about the plane. But I thought, gee, unmanned bat-winged Sentinel drone captures it. That shows how poetry is so much better. I think we'll take a break. This is the Taylor Report, and the Taylor Report is really grateful to all the support the station has been getting during our fundraising, and particularly for this show, the Taylor Report. We had a lot of I'm just going to tell you a lot of names. They tell me it's a record for a 1-hour talk show, I think. if I'm in trouble for that, I'll come back and correct that. I think that's accurate. We like to be accurate. All right. This is a Data Report. We'll be back in a moment.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back, Taylor Report. Hey, by the way, the Ontario Federation of Labour had a great demonstration on Saturday, and that is good news for people of Ontario and labour everywhere. 15,000 is what the local press is giving them, led by Sid Ryan and the Ontario Federation. I'm impressed with that. They had a good slogan, prosperity, not austerity. And it's good that we're getting a little labor is showing itself again in numbers and at Queen's Park. And this comes at a time when we have going on in Quebec, that other country, which is somewhere just off Portugal, I think, Quebec, where 200,000 students and supporters and labor are acting. It's good to see this stirring.
Yeah, and you know, Philip, it's reached that moment in Quebec when some of the old rulers from an earlier era told Charest yesterday, you are in danger of destroying the social contract that is Quebec, and you need to cancel your raises. And I saw some of the names. These are like old right-wing cabinet ministers from Bourassa's era. And I think, oh, this is an interesting development. And it's like, I think that these are guys who, because they had power once and they're now retired, can look at it and say, you know, you should know when you're beat, right? Uh-huh. And if you don't know when you're beat, then it's going to be a disaster for the whole society. And that's what they're basically saying to Charest. Yeah. But my guess is that Charest is not listening.
Yeah. No, this is, we have this fact of Canadian life. We have, we are solitudes. And there is, most of the media here is very hostile to this, because as Chomsky pointed out in his message to the students, he said many countries do not have tuition, many civilized countries, and he said you don't have to have tuition. That's just a superstition of the culture. Students in Quebec have been always very active. And they're well organized, and they have the lowest tuition because of that. And so what we're in now is a political battle, which is defines the career of Charest. He was sent to Quebec. Remember, Charest was the progressive conservative.
He was the party leader in the House of Commons.
He was the party leader. Yeah. And the NDP and the Liberals all endorsed him to please go to Quebec and leave the federal parliament and become kind of the United Front representative us of Canada. We're called the rest of Canada.
ROC. The ROC administrator.
We're almost
for Quebec.
Like, yeah. We're turning into kind of Korea. People say we're like Belgium. I think we're maybe like Korea, but at any rate, they said, you go down there and you straighten these people out. You speak French, you do it. And so off he went. He was, and the parliamentarians all stood up and applauded that. Well, it's coming home to roost. This is your guy. You sent him. He was supposed to teach him neoliberalism and rough him up. And as Chrétien used to say of his own role, he used to say, my job is to kill the dream. He said that, to kill the dream of a sovereign Quebec. So he's a dream killer. And of course, Mr. Charest, he's another dream killer. And I tell you guys and the rest of Canada, you're the ones who are dreaming. You're finding out that the working people of Quebec fought very hard to get what they've got. And they do have a different way of looking at things. And the best we could do would be to emulate them and certainly show more respect toward them. But I think it's a terrific thing that this is going on. And it has been going on a while. When people say, oh, it'll blow over. These are students, you know, very insulting. Oh, they're just students. Well, it turns out they're very sophisticated. Everybody I know who comments on this has something to say about how talented they are and how inventive. And even their enemies, like Lise Gagnon writing in the Globe and Mail, she said, well, you know, they have to hand it to them. They're very creative. We got to do something. I noticed that we're still trying to get Ann Garrison. We're having a little problem. But I noticed that they in characterizing, I'm trying to lose track of my thought here about these students. I'll let you fill your listening on. I'll find my note and there's something I want to make. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to comment that Charest this weekend hosted some big convention for mining promoters. And, of course, this is the latest thing. And Canada is now the center of excellence, if that's the word, that the international bankers like to use for mining promotion, which means basically accumulating capital to invade indigenous areas of the world and just grab the resources of those people. And northern Quebec, which, of course, most of it is native territory, has been identified as one such place. And it's interesting, when the Parti Québécois was in power and they wanted to do anything in northern Quebec, all we ever heard was, oh, my God, you know, they're Canadians up there and you have no right to go up there. You know, but now that Charest, who really reports to Bay Street, it doesn't report to the Quebec people, now that he says he wants to do it, well, that's perfectly okay. And right. And they have made a link between the fact that he wants to raise the tuition and he wants to hand over billions of dollars of Quebec resources to these people for nothing, right? And the students are making that link, which I think is terrific.
Yeah. No, it's and I notice his negotiating technique with the students is that, you know, they have these big demonstrations. The police suddenly change the ground rules for a demonstration. For example, they're now giving out tickets. You see, if you disrupt traffic or whatnot, they write you a ticket and create other. So that's to put you on the wrong foot. That's going to make you have economic. You're going to have to pay for that. You're going to maybe have to get a lawyer and whatnot. And then they also begin to rough them up. And there's been some violence. And the students say, well, this is a usual, he said, they said. But of course, the media plays it this way. The government says students claim. Government says students claim. You know, it's not on equal footing. And then once they've had a little bit of violence, and there has been some. One student, incidentally, lost his eye. He was, I think, hit with
that
a
was
canister.
That was very early. The first week of the demonstration.
He was hit with a canister,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
At any rate, so Charest, instead of going to the dealing with substantial matters, immediately says, well, I'm not going to talk to you until you renounce all the student violence. Well, of course, the students do not feel that they have initiated any violence. And if Mr. Charest wants to go to court and show, I suppose that could be an interesting place to find out. But they don't accept his language. But here, everyone says, oh, that's fair. I mean, sure, you shouldn't talk to the students until they agree to your political language describing their student struggle against extravagant tuition increases. And everyone's comfortable with that. But if President Assad in Syria says, hey, you guys are shooting at my soldiers, I'm not talking to you until you stop shooting, everybody says, oh, boy, get a load of this guy. Whoa, there's a crackpot. Armed groups are shooting at his soldiers, and he can't say, I'm not talking till that stops. Oh, no. No, he's responsible. But in the case of Mr. Charest's right. He can have his police rough people up, put them in situations where violence occurs, and then he makes a demand. They have to say things that he likes before he will deign to talk to them. This is, you know, he's trying to break them. I don't think they're breakable, by the way. He looks pretty fragile, but they don't. We are still attempting to reach Ann Garrison. This is a unique situation. She's a very talented journalist. She's in Berkeley, California. She broadcasts for KPFA Berkeley. That's one of the places you can hear her. You can find her on the web at anngarrison.com. And we know that she has interviewed the lead lawyer in the case of Miss Ingeberry, and so I'm going to cover what I know. His name is Ian Edwards. I know Mr. Edwards. Full disclosure. He took over in this case. Listeners may remember that Peter Erlander, an American lawyer, had been the first counsel represent Ms. Ingabire in Rwanda. And Mr. Erlander is a law professor in Minnesota. He was himself arrested. He was held under difficult circumstances. There was actually quite a bit of attention to that matter. Democracy Now!, which you hear on the mornings at CIUT, they covered the events surrounding the arrest of Peter Erlander. It was quite dramatic. He ended up being, I think, expelled from the country, and therefore he had to step aside as her counsel. And she, she then obtained Ian Edwards, and Ian Edwards, together with a Rwandan-based lawyer, representative, the Rwandan's lawyer's name is Gatwara, I believe. He's a heroic individual because he was in court when things began to go south with her attempt to defend herself. And just outlining what we know about this case, is that there had been, as I mentioned earlier, four witnesses. There might have been five, but four of the witnesses were in custody, and they were co-accused. This is, get a load of this, Phil. This is worthy of something Machiavelli. You know, the word is overused, but this one you got to hand it to him. And I've seen this in North American courtrooms.
Oh, yes.
I have seen it in Canadian.
American prosecutors love this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So they say, oh, you have a co-accused. We're not just accusing you. We're accusing you. You have a co-accused. You say, well, I've never heard of him. Well, he's heard of you. He says he's your pal. And he says you did it. He's pleading guilty. We accused him together with you. He's pleading guilty. And he says you were the leader. And you say, who is he? I say, well, he's been here for 4 years, and we've gotten to know him, and he's finally decided to tell us the whole truth. Yeah, well, that's interesting. They didn't have any of these guys, by the way, making claims about her till they arrested her. And then they put these guys. So then they all said, oh, yeah, we were part of this. Now, of course, you can't – this is never going to work. This is a 43-year-old woman with three children and a husband in Holland. She's been in Holland all this time. She has been – she did tour around North America. She was in Canada. She spoke in Montreal before returning to Rwanda. She is an advocate of parliamentary change. She believes in democracy and elections. And she said, since the government of Rwanda says it does, that's what I want. Of course, they can't have it that way. They have to have her. The charge against her is that she's connected to a guerrilla organization. So, and that she's, you know, like a co-leader of an armed group. And
from Holland. I mean, she's been in Holland leading this armed group for the last 20 years. But the Dutch authorities never disrupted it.
They never found any evidence. She wasn't accused of this until she got to Rwanda. Then they decided that she was.
So she just showed up off the airplane one day to run for president, but that was just a cover to organize an armed group.
Right.
Oh.
Yes. So they brought these witnesses. And so she brought one. Now, here's what happened to my understanding, and I'm going to refer you to AnnGarrison.com or to Victoire-Ingabire.org, and you can read some of the details. But I was looking. I had access to a lawyer's motion from the Arusha Tribunal, because this is connected to the cases of all those accused before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in Arusha, Tanzania. There is an individual there named Uwamindi. I think I mispronounced it, but he'll forgive me. He does not wish to be extradited, removed, I should say, from Tanzania, from the International UN Court, to Rwanda to be tried there. There's been a thing organized between the government of Rwanda and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. These are two separate jurisdictions, but one jurisdiction has decided to help the other one out by transferring this gentleman. So he says, based on what has happened in the courtroom with Victoire Ingabire, you should not transfer me. you have to return me to your court, because in your court, I assume you wouldn't do what was done in her court. And here's an example of what they did. She called one witness. He was identified correctly. There's no question about who he is. He's Lieutenant Colonel Habimana. And Lieutenant Colonel Habimana is a self-acknowledged former leader of a guerrilla organization that had been in Congo. He had been captured there in 2009 and transferred to Rwanda. And he said, I don't know her. He came in the court and they said, here's what I got to do. This is so much fun. Here's what they bring him in the court and the court says, well, who's this? And they said, well, this is Lieutenant Colonel, Habimana. And he is in prison here in Rwanda and we want him to testify for Victoire Ingabire. So the prosecution says, he can't, Your Honor, you can't be a witness for the defense. And they said, well, why? And they said, because we found him guilty of crimes. And he was an FDLR guy. And we found him guilty of all these things. And anyone found guilty can't be a witness. You can see he's a criminal, so... You can't call him. He's in prison, but you can't call him. So then the defense, rather smartly, said, well, wait a minute. Okay. How about the court just ask him for entry? Because Your Honor, he's a leading member. Your court said he was a leading member of an organization. We think he could help the court understand whether something bad has happened. Hey, we're joined by Ann Garrison. Are you there, Ann? You're almost there. I swear I heard her voice. Are you there, Ann?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there. That's pretty good.
That's good? I'm sorry about the knobs on the board here.
This is Ann Garrison. Ann Garrison.
Having various technical problems. But here I am now, and I was listening to part of it. It sounded like you reported what happened in the courtroom, and then you reported on the attempt to prevent the Uwinkindi transfer from Arusha to Kigali, which was not successful.
You are on the ball. You are reporting my report very accurately now. But you're the one who knows. You interviewed Mr. Ian Edwards. And by the way, we really admire your work on following this case. So could you continue on the story or just tell us what caused Victoire Ingabire to decide to give up but to withdraw from this show trial?
Her first witness, Michelle Habimana, who is a former commander in the FDLR, that's the army, at least we're told. I'm never quite sure, to tell you the truth, what the FDLR is, but mm-hmm. it's supposed to be what was left of the Rwandan army, which regrouped in eastern Congo, which is President Kagame's constant excuse for invading the eastern Congo, mm-hmm. that he's got to go after this army to make sure that they don't come back. Michelle Habimana is serving a life sentence in a Rwandan prison. The defense summoned him, and he testified that the prosecution's lead witness was lying, that Victoire Ingabire had never had any contact with the FDLR, and that the prosecution's lead witness was lying about being a top officer in the FDLR. Mm-hmm. And Ian Edwards said that he no doubt did this at great risk to himself or sacrifice, despite the fact that he's already serving life in prison. And I'm a little uncertain about the order in which this happened, but when he gave this testimony, he was ordered from the courtroom. And I can't quite tell whether it was before or after, but his cell was searched, and it seems he had written a statement. He had prepared a statement. He was going to read in court. Mm-hmm. And he thought there was something criminal about this. So when I saw their first defense witness treated this way, and they had also lost on the issue of jurisdiction, she had been accused of speech crime in the Netherlands, speech which is illegal in Rwanda, which means disagreeing with the history of the Rwanda genocide, and she'd been accused of breaking laws that had not been written when she allegedly broke them in the Netherlands, meaning they passed these genocide ideology laws in 2008, newly harsh genocide ideology statutes against disagreeing with the government or the history of the genocide, and she was accused of having done so before 2008.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to go on and continue to legitimize the trial. Some people said she should have done this earlier, but I think it was very good timing, because this made it obvious that they had made every effort to treat this like a real judicial process.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no point in continuing to legitimize it. And, you know, she comported herself just with the usual elegance.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see, what else can I say about that? That's why she decided to give up. And she made a really moving statement. She said that this movement, the movement that she had started, is stronger than she is, and it won't be possible to turn it back. Now, Rwandan refugees from all over the world have thanked her for making it possible for them to tell their stories, and her party, the FDU, is now going to ask the UN Office of the Commissioner on Human Rights. That's the one that put out the mapping report in October 2010. They're going to ask that she be declared a political prisoner. And I'm not sure what the category is, whether it's actually political prisoner or prisoner of conscience, something like that, that gives her a different status.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something I don't know much about, what sort of international status one has when one is identified as a prisoner of conscience or political prisoner by the UN, UN Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
But that is her party's next move.
Mm-hmm. It's a very logical one, and it would be bringing it up to date, her true identity. This is someone who was a leader of a party and wanted to run for office. That is what she really wanted to do, and they have decided to bring these absurd charges, but also conduct the case in such a way that now other accused, such as that Mr. Windy in Arusha, is making a very good argument that he shouldn't be transferred to Rwanda because of the way they treat accused.
Now, there are countries all over the world that are allowing these extraditions. And there was just a big fight over one of these cases in New Hampshire that looks like the second loss on an attempt to extradite a Rwandan American and U.S. citizen back to Rwanda. They can do this because they claim genocide crime, and genocide crime has no statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
According to the UN definition.
Mm-hmm.
In this case in New Hampshire, they actually introduced some satellite photos. And Keith Harmon Snow wrote a piece about how startling it was that these satellite photos suddenly been introduced in this courtroom as though they were going to prove something about the genocide and this woman's involvement. They didn't really prove anything, and the jury concluded that as well. But they brought in an intelligence expert to interpret these photos. And the shocking thing was that no such photos, no satellite photos, had ever been produced at the ICTR.
Yeah, the UN tried it.
18 years later, was the Pentagon coming up with these satellite photos of Rwanda in 1994, and what were they doing with them then?
Yes. It's very telling that, of course, by the way, going to your side, going to AnnGarrison.com. I noticed photographs of U.S. military personnel training Rwandans, and they have a nice label for their joint work. But you can kind of, you see, you understand why Ms. Ingabire is in such trouble. She's interfering with that partnership.
Yeah, and she doesn't really talk about that very much. I mean, it's only those of us who are citizens in the West who can talk about it safely. I mean, that would be very unwise mm-hmm. for her.
Oh, indeed. It is one of those things which I'm sure she's somewhat interested in, but she's actually challenging, saying, if you believe and are committed to a parliamentary system, I'm here and I'm ready to be a candidate.
Exactly. And I should say, though, I never had a chance to talk to Victoire about Barack Obama. I did talk to her daughter about it. I've spoken to her daughter a number of times and put her on WBAI and KPFA. And I believe that the first time I asked her whether she had been hopeful about Barack Obama, and she said yes. That was probably a year or so ago. She was aware of the amount of institutional force that he would be up against. And I think Raisa and her Victoire and her family and so many other African people I know were hopeful and would still like to see something mm-hmm. positive about the American Africa, the U.S.-Africa relationship come out of Barack Obama's election. But this sort of political organization and consciousness necessary to make that happen hasn't been there. But one of the things that I have pointed to a lot, and Friends of the Congo does as well, is that Barack Obama's own legislation, his 2006 Senate bill, the Congo Relief, which became law, the only law that he ever shepherded through on his own, it has his name alone on it, the Obama Congo Relief Security and Democracy Promotion Act of 2006, says that Uganda and Rwanda are using the presence of real or perceived hostile militias as an excuse to interfere in the Congo. Mm-hmm. Now, interfere is a pretty mild word for it, but still, this piece of legislation tells the truth about that.
Yes.
And so, and it belies what Obama is saying, probably with all the institutional force surrounding him now, such as that he's going to go after Joseph Kony.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that if one thing is familiar about the African story now, it's this Kony 2012 nonsense. Obama made a statement this today, I think, about that. And there's all kinds of legislation that's been introduced in the U.S. Congress after Kony 2012 to increase the militarization, increase the troop levels, and isolate Omar al-Bashir and Sudan, meaning the north, which is really the main target of this Kony 2012 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But Barack Obama knows the truth.
Yeah.
He wrote a bill about it.
Indeed.
In 2006.
Well, there have been UN reports. And I think it's cited on a couple of the when I went to research over your articles and whatnot, I did see citations of UN reports of crimes committed by the Kagame forces documented by the United Nations. They say there's no question that those soldiers were killing civilians deliberately. I wonder, what about Netherlands? Netherlands seems to have a special responsibility. Have you thought about that?
Actually, something may happen there. I called Victoria's daughter, Raisa, to ask whether Victoria had citizenship. If she had citizenship in the Netherlands, I think it would be a different situation. But when the evidence came out that this witness, her primary defense witness, her first defense witness, had been harassed, intimidated, threatened, possibly bribed, ordered out of the courtroom,
mm-hmm.
There was some kind of disturbance in Dutch Parliament about it. And a member of her party, of the FDU, told me that the Dutch are actually embarrassed because of all they've invested in training the Rwandan judiciary.
Actually, the training seems to be paying off. It's
I mean, the Dutch ambassador is not one of the people on Victoria's side, but I think the government is probably, people in the government who are aware of this are probably divided about it.
Well, they certainly, their behavior so far has given folks like you and myself plenty to work on, because they are a walking disgrace. Ann Garrison, we're really sorry we had trouble getting in touch with you. It was a lot of information. We do appreciate it, and we'll hope to talk to you again in the near future.
Thanks so much, Phil.
Okay.
So much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. AnnGarrison.com. And I think we are just about to the end here. I want to thank everybody again for all the support for the station and Taylor Report. This is where you go for all your tailoring services, I assume. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out, taylor-report.com. Carol, thanks very much. Phil, and we'll see you next week.